Hello and welcome back to the Emerge Podcast. Today I'm joined by Bob Falconer. Bob is the author of the book The Others Within Us, and I first became aware of his work on a podcast about internal family systems called IFS Talks. And really, it's one of those times when, like, the first time I heard Bob's voice, I was like, who is this person? And then as I heard him actually say what he had to say, I immediately knew that I wanted to read his book and to speak with him. I think, you know, he's a true elder. His experience and participation in the transformation of psychology and therapy in the United States culture, and really the world culture, is fascinating and important. And his book, The Others Within Us, is, well, you'll hear about it, but if you don't yet know or understand or make sense of, if you haven't made sense of the reality of what has been historically known as things like possession or entities that exist in this reality, then you should read the book. You should listen to this podcast, because it's significant. The reality of it is significant, and it matters for our view on reality and on our minds and what we are. And so I really enjoyed this conversation with Bob Falconer. I could talk to him for days. You know, he's just a wonderful conversationalist, and his journey, his personal journey also, which we discuss, is profound and inspiring. So I really hope that you enjoy this episode. And if you'd like to, you know, you may have noticed, if you follow along the podcast, that I've been, you know, absent from the internet. I haven't posted a new podcast in a number of months. And this episode is actually recorded a long time ago, maybe like 6 months ago, and I'm just releasing it now for various reasons. And if you'd like to know more about my absence and what I've been working on, you're welcome to join my Patreon. My intention is to kind of share more intimate details about my process and my work, and be a little bit messier there. And so if you'd like to witness the mess, or at least hear more from me, you're welcome to become a Patreon, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes. Okay, that's all for now. Please enjoy this episode of Emerge with Bob Falconer. Welcome back to the Emerge Podcast. Today on the show, I'm joined by Bob Falconer. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Good to be here.
Yeah, great. And so I discovered you and your work relatively recently through, I think it was the IFS Talks podcast. And they had, you know, there's a conversation with you about your new book, The Others Within Us, which, you know, I think the listeners will know, and it bears saying that a lot of the times that I choose guests on the show, it's just because, you know, I'm out on the internet just kind of listening to different things, and then suddenly I'll hear somebody. And really nowadays what happens is that I just have a kind of trust response in my body. Honestly, there's like a kind of resonance in my body. Maybe it's in my soul, if you believe in such things. And I kind of just like, ooh, this person. And then I just kind of start exploring their work and their world. And so it was a real joy to find you and your work, because, you know, not only have you written what I think is just a really wonderful book called The Others Within Us, but you also have a whole lifetime of experience and kind of history within the evolution of psychology and spirit and healing culture in the U.S., I suppose, and then also your own personal story, which I've only recently learned more about, is just completely fascinating and a kind of testament to, I think, the potential and power of healing work. And so, yeah, really, really excited just to spend some time exploring and hearing your story and reflections.
Great.
Yeah. So maybe we can start with, if you're willing to share your story of kind of how you came to therapy, to healing work, what was your life like such that that became your vocation?
Okay. I was raised in a family that looked good from the outside. We went to church. Dad was employed, lived in Manhattan in New York City, but it was all addiction and sadistic sexual and physical abuse in the family that was successfully kept secret. Both of my parents were alcoholics. Dad drank at least 6 beers every day. In his standard, that didn't even count as drinking. And he did often drink way more than that. Mom was more of a binge drinker and more of a pill addict, prescription medicines. Dad very often had his child molesting, quote, friends living in the house with us. So there were several adult males sexually abusing me and my brother, and my mom also sexually abused us. She was institutionalized a few times while I was still at home in mental institutions. Really extreme abuse. And I don't know why, but I feel moved to sort of jump into the deep end. Extreme sadistic sexual abuse. I learned very early how to numb out almost anything that happened to me, including like if they put cigarettes out on me, I could just numb it out. The one thing I never could learn how to numb out was being suffocated. I think that's some hardwired biological response. And I think that's, what we've been doing in Guantanamo to those people, that's torture. That's a sophisticated and extreme form of torture. Just because it doesn't leave any marks doesn't change that at all. So I would go into these, spasms and flailing and, total reaction to being suffocated. So, of course, when he found that out, that's what he did all the time. And when I was suffocated unconscious, I don't know if these count as a near-death experience or not. I think that's sort of just names. But I met a merciful female presence. And I was so grateful to meet her. But then I actually came to hate her and I cursed her because she kept sending me back. I did not want to go back to being alive, and being raped and beaten and, all these other things. And then I cursed her and, directed hate at her, and she disappeared for many decades. I couldn't contact her at all. Anyway, childhood goes on. My brother was almost 2 years older. He started abusing me too. When he was 18 and I was 16, he committed suicide. My father was murdered a few years later. So by all odds, I should be in prison, dead, living in a dumpster. the prognosis is not good, right? And now in my mid-70s, I think of myself as a joy-filled human being. And I feel I'm doing very productive and important work. And I have a loving wife and really good friends. So my life shouldn't have happened. there's lots of ways that spirit sort of snuck into my life, like that one I just mentioned. And there were other little ones where I didn't recognize it as spirit until many years later. I'll just mention one other one. I was not like other kids. They didn't like me. I didn't like them. I was always the outcast and the reject and the scapegoat wherever I went, whatever school I went. So I was thrown out of a lot of schools and I became sort of a bully and I learned how to fight. And then once I was in this one school and it was a nice little religious school, and I had this kid up by the lapels in the coat room and I was going to start hitting him. And I put, this was ninth grade, I put him down and I brushed his lapels off, and I've never hit anyone in anger since then. Now, I'd like to claim credit for that because I'm a great soul or something. That's malarkey. I think spirit came into that little cloakroom. And I could eat, you know, thrown out of a few more schools, a little more trouble, I would have gone to juvie hall and then jail. That other pathway was right there.
Right.
And there were some other. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I suppose I'm curious, like, you know, in another video I watched of yours, and you said something similar just now, that you described yourself as a man of joy. And I think that's like, just, I guess I'm curious, like, for you, what does it mean that you, or that a human being more generally, can go from the kind of childhood you had to being a man of joy, to living a joy-filled life? Like, what does that kind of indicate about the nature of mind, the nature of spirit, the nature of healing?
Okay. I'll sort of jump over all the other stuff and say, one of the great gifts of IFS is Dick has this idea that we're made up of parts and self. And self is this core. It's curious, calm, compassionate, creative. He's got 8 C's. I always forget a bunch of them. Connected, clear, you know, all these things. Curious and compassionate are the two most important. And he says, this is who you really are. And it can't ever be damaged or even dirty. Now, this goes against what almost all the earlier therapists I'd been with said. They said, basically, you know, you've been destroyed. You know, expect a small, miserable life was basically their message. You're damaged goods. But he said, no, who you really are cannot even be dirtied. And that was a very, very important message for me to hear. And also for all, because I worked mainly with guys with histories like mine for many, many years. For them to hear, no, you're not damaged goods. Who you really are isn't even dirty. It's like the sun on the stormiest day. Doesn't matter. Your house is blown down. The whole place is flooded. Those clouds part, and the sun is there. Resplendent, vast, radiant, undamaged, not even affected. And that's who we really are. We really are that sun. You know, I think Pema Chodron said something like, you know, you are the sky, everything else is just weather.
Yes.
It's a very similar kind of idea.
Yeah, and I think in your story also is a sense that I get of the transformation and evolution of how the mind is treated within the U.S. Like, I think we had a short call just to kind of prepare for this recording. And you told me about a textbook, I think from the late 60s, that had a certain kind of stance on child sexual abuse. Can you kind of share with the audience like what it was like during that time?
There was a major psychiatric textbook that was used in med schools across America that said incest occurs less than 1 in 1 million cases. It's extremely rare. And when it happens, it's often good for the child. And the academic therapeutic establishment denied the importance of child sexual abuse. They claimed it hardly ever happened. And when it did, it didn't really matter. And it was a grassroots movement that forced them to accept this as a reality. And they fought against it. The same thing with PTSD, which now, you know, the very same schools that resisted this diagnosis with all their might are now, well, we're the big trauma-oriented expert. I'm glad they've come around, but it sure would be nice to hear, gee, I'm sort of sorry we were so wrong. PTSD was forced down the throat of academia by the Vietnam War veterans rap groups. They all knew it was real. Most of them had it. And, you know, they'd get together talking. And then finally, this one psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Lifton, organized them. They did not go to the academic institutions or the powers that be in the therapy world. They went to Washington, D.C. and lobbied Congress and the government. And that put enough pressure on the professionals so that they finally had to let PTSD into the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the sort of Bible of diagnosis in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's an interesting parallel here. I mean, you and I, before we started recording, were talking about the emergence of psychedelic churches out in the kind of California area. And part of the kind of catalyst for the mainstreaming of psychedelics was veterans, you know, advocating for the use of psychedelics to work with their trauma.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. MDMA is the best treatment currently available for PTSD. The results are astounding. MAPS, that organization, has been working for almost 30 years now to get MDMA approved, and they've spent tens of millions of dollars, and it still isn't complete. There's something a little bit crazy about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so I think part of the reason why it's so, why I really wanted to speak with you is, you know, I'm 36 and I've worked in the kind of spiritual healing world for 15 years, mostly in the context of like Buddhist practice and kind of the Buddhist world. And I think I see a lot of folks who are kind of my contemporaries and especially like younger, who I think take for granted some of the really hard won battles for shifting the kind of cultural conception of mind. And then in taking that for granted, I think they then don't really perhaps see the potential for its further unfoldment and evolution, the kind of possibility of really pushing the edge of what our culture conceives as like possible when it comes to healing or what the mind is or what the human is. And so I wonder if you could describe a little bit to give a kind of, I don't know, maybe a sense, and you can take this however you want, but like of the evolution that you saw over the last, you know, your graduate work, I suppose you started in like 71. Is that right?
I didn't go straight to grad school.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, but you were super involved with like Esalen, you know, you were there for this whole thing that, you know, I and many people that I talk to, my contemporaries are like kind of born into. And so I think we can lose track of it. So what did you, yeah, what's it been like to see this kind of evolution of this world?
I was one of the first men in America to publicly get up in front of people and say I was sexually abused as a child.
Hmm.
And the response I got was often that people were incredulous. And there would sort of, you know, there was almost sneering, not quite, but, you know, not respect, let's put it there. But then people would come up to me in the hall and sort of whisper, me too. Hmm. You know, and it started with some therapists and small, there was an organization here in Santa Cruz where I live called Survivors Healing Center. It was a storefront operation run on a shoestring budget, and they were treating abuse before any of these big institutions were. And the big institutions were going, no, that's nuts. And then there were a bunch of other sort of maverick people who said, no, this really happens, and it really devastates people. And I worked very hard at this, and my feeling was I was actually the executive director of something called the Institute for Trauma-Oriented Psychotherapy, because people didn't recognize trauma back then. And what we worked towards was once the Vietnam veterans and the sexual abuse survivors get together and these two streams come together, it overwhelmingly shows what trauma does to a person's mind and soul. Mm. And so I was really, really, really working to help those rivers flow together.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. And now it's totally mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think another, an advantage that this history gives me, I don't trust the experts. Mm. You know, hey guys, you were so wrong just a few years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something I've heard you say, is that like, it's great that they've kind of updated to now foreground trauma work, but also it might be nice if they admitted how off they were.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even better, he might still be really wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. Have some humility about the territory. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That humility is in short supply.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the therapy world is, it's very competitive, and there are all these people trying to push their way to the front. You know, sharp elbows, and I'm the big shot expert, and look at me, look at me. It's not very pretty.
Mm.
And there are all these competing schools of psychotherapy. There was a guy, Bakken, back in the 60s, wrote a book called Sigmund Freud and the Jewish Mystical Tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And his main point was that many of Freud's ideas came out of the Jewish mystical tradition, which is true. But the thing he said that was even more significant to me is that the sociological structure of psychotherapy is very like the sociological structure of the Hasidic Jews in 17th, 18th, 19th century Eastern Europe. There are all these different, you know, powerful rabbis or therapists who gather followings around each other, and then they battle each other in a sort of competitive way.
Yeah.
It is. It is not a science thing, not at all.
Yeah. And there's a way that, you know, the sharp elbowing, and, you know, and we might not dive deep into this, but just to give a sense of the kind of territory that I think is in your book, that the sharp elbowing to some degree is an emergent property of trying to create healing therapeutic modalities within capitalism, right? That there's a really interesting intertangling that you write about between kind of imperialism or empire and the therapeutic industry.
Yeah, and they came, you know, Freud and all those beginnings of this idea of the unconscious or subconscious came at the same time imperialism was at its height.
Hmm.
And I think you can see many, I don't like Freud. let me be transparent about that. But you can see his kind of therapy as an imperialism of the psyche, whereas the ego is trying to colonize the entire rest of the mind and to control it. And I've been working some with indigenous people here, and they often see therapy as another form of colonialism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think there is something to that kind of connection.
Yeah. 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 And so, you know, you don't like Freud, but you do like internal family systems. So this is kind of the modality that after all of your searching and your 100+ workshops at Esalen and your kind of full exploration of your own, you know, crevices of your psyche, you kind of have stepped forward into IFS as being like the most, I think you say like, I guess, how would you describe it? It's the modality that you've really chosen to put forward as the thing that is most helpful. So yeah. What was that like to discover that, and why IFS?
Well, what I say about it, it's the most potent and respectful. Yeah. And I actually think it is potent because it is respectful. It's very respectful of the client. You know, this idea that who they really are is undamaged. And also another big IFS idea is the client is the healer. We just help them access that healing energy that is there inside them undamaged. and we don't ever try and, you know, give them some brilliant interpretation that's going to straighten out their whole life. No. Mm-hmm. We help them access the wisdom that's deep in their bones, in their bodies. Mm. There are many other modalities that I think are good. I think to be effective, a modality must orient around multiplicity of mind, because I think that's the way things are organized. We're made up of parts. We're not one unified thing. That would be, Dick calls it the myth of the mono mind. Mm-hmm. And we're much more like a symphony orchestra than a vocalist. Mm. We're much more like a tennis player. We're much more like a football team than a tennis player. Mm. You know, there's all these different parts with all these different skills. Most people are walking around, they're like a civil war. Most of their psychic energy goes into internal battles. You know, I want another drink. No, you got drunk last night. That kind of stuff. And very little is left over for living. Mm-hmm. So the model of healing would be converting an internal civil war into a chorus or an orchestra or some kind of team that functions really, really well together.
Yeah. 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 And IFS itself now is an extremely popular modality. Like the IFS level one, you know, has a wait list of, I don't know, you know, probably like somebody told me 20,000 people are on the wait list.
Yeah, something like that now, yeah.
So a friend of mine said they got into level one and I was shocked. I didn't know that. It's like, I finally met somebody who's gotten into level one. And so there's a kind of, you know, mainstreaming happening to a certain degree of internal family systems. And like, and you can kind of see just like the idea of trauma sort of entered the culture, the idea of the multiplicity of mind is entering the culture too.
Yeah, and that idea has been around a very long time. The book I did before this, which I co-authored with Dick Schwartz, the founder of IFS, is all about all these other cultures and historical eras and people who've concluded that mind is multiple, including Plato, Socrates. You know, yeah. It's not new at all, but it keeps sort of coming up and then getting suppressed or hidden again. Mm-hmm. I think it's very, very disconcerting for people. It's one of what I think of as the progressive dethronements of the human. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to think we're the center of the world and the world is flat and the whole cosmos is oriented around us. Mm-hmm. And that got taken away from us, you know, the world's around, you know, the sun, not us. And then, oh, we're just one tiny little bit of this vast universe. Mm-hmm. And I think this idea of multiplicity is a dethronement and a much more personal one. It's about who we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And so as this is kind of, you know, to some degree, at least in some parts of, if there is such a thing still as mainstream culture, this idea of the multiplicity of mind, I think is really kind of becoming really widespread. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, as IFS is gaining in popularity, and trauma is kind of everywhere, you know, that trauma informed everything now. Mm-hmm. You've written a book called The Others Within Us. Yep. Yeah. And what would you say, what would you say the book is about, and what were you hoping to accomplish with writing it? Because in a sense, I see you as writing, yes, for a large audience, but also in a kind of conversation with internal family systems.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely based on internal family systems. I think there's another step that internal family systems didn't make or has only partially made. And this is the big picture thing. Mind is not only multiple, it's also porous. Hmm. And if you think about it for a minute, all living systems are porous. Every living cell is surrounded by a semi-permeable membrane. I mean, it's sort of like dumb obvious when you think about it. But our culture is built upon a very, very opposite idea to this. And There's a magnificent anthropologist, Tanya Luhrmann, who I think is one of the major intellects alive on the planet today. And she talks about it. She says, we have what she calls the citadel theory of mind. We think who we are is contained in our skull, and it's everything, every thought we have is private, it's ours, and it constitutes our identity. And that's absolutely wrong. Our mind is permeable, and stuff comes in and out. And it looks sort of strong, you know, it looks like a fortress, but actually it's incredibly brittle and therefore fragile. And I do in the book go into a lot of detail. This idea really got big around the Reformation and Counter-Reformation. And as it got bigger and bigger, there's been more and more mental illness in the West. And I think you can make a very strong case that this fundamental conception of who we are underlies many of our modern problems. If we really realized how porous we were, we couldn't treat the environment the way we do.
Right.
Yeah, it would be right. All my relations.
Yes.
It wouldn't be that. And this Charles Taylor at the McGill University in Montreal has written a great deal about this. He calls it the buffered self.
Yes. Yeah.
But anyway, so I think where I'm going in this book is a little bit beyond where IFS is comfortable going. And I just want to say, if I sound woo-woo or sort of nutsy, blame it on me, not IFS.
Well, I think that one of the things I really appreciate about this is that this isn't just kind of, or isn't simply philosophical. It's based in and rooted in the stories of your clients and the stories of your practice as a kind of clinician. And so maybe could you share like the story that sort of, you know, I don't know if you'd use this frame, but kind of broke open your mind to the porosity of the mind.
Yeah. And it was a somewhat unpleasant experience because I thought I had stuff figured out. I was teaching IFS and being what they call a program assistant. And one of my jobs was to run a little triad. And in that triad, the people learning IFS, one's the role of a therapist, one's a client, and another's an observer. And I'm there to intervene and help them to do this, their session in an IFS way. And this guy was doing this session, and this thing, what we thought was a part at first in the client showed up, but it did not have the characteristics of a part. And I'd heard there were these things that in IFS at the time called them critters. Now they call them unattached burdens, a name I really don't like. But the basic idea in IFS is we're made up of all these parts. There are no bad parts. They all have a good intention. And what we want to help them do is connect to their good intention and stop fighting with each other and drop their burdens, all these beliefs and extreme emotions they took on. So this thing didn't seem to have a good intention at all. And I asked the guy who was being the therapist, I said, I don't think you've been trained in this stuff at all. Would you mind if I took over the session? And he just went, please. Because this was, you know, a fairly upsetting kind of session. What the woman was seeing in her inner world was a bloodshot eyeball with legs. And it had a very, very critical voice. And it kept telling her, you know, what a horrible individual she was, how disgusting she looked, you know, on and on and on and on. Inner critics are common parts. Almost everybody has them. But if you stay with them a while, they have a good intention. Like, if I criticize her enough, she won't take any risks and she won't get hurt. You know, or if I criticize her enough, mom won't be criticizing her.
Right.
You know, there's some you can get to. With this one, no matter what we did, there was no good intention in there anywhere, you know? And what do you want with all your criticism? I want to destroy her. Well, suicidal parts often have a good intention. So what would be good about destroying her? Then she wouldn't be on the planet anymore. Still, there could be a good intention. what's good about her not being on the planet anymore? And then this thing said, well, that means I win. And, you know, absolutely no good intention, just destroy. So then the next thing to do with these, and I knew hardly nothing about these things, was to just have the client ask, are you a part of me? She started asking and kept avoiding the question, saying stuff like, well, I've been around your whole life. And no, that's not, you know, all sorts of evasive answers. And then I just tell him, keep asking, stay calm, keep asking. And then the voice through her said to me, you're supposed to be a teacher. That's a really stupid question. Don't you have anything smarter to ask? And I said, it might be stupid, but it's really simple. Are you a part of her? And this went on for a while. And then finally, it sort of roared out through her. No, I'm not a part of her. I'm a much more glorious being. And I'm going to crush her like a worm, the same way I'm going to crush you. And for some reason, I was totally unafraid. And I just did some very simple things of moving it out of her system, making sure her parts were okay. And I debriefed the group in a very rational, calm way. And we all went back to the training. And then I went into the staff meeting and my core body temperature dropped like 3-4 degrees. I couldn't get warm even with a blanket. And some of my friends on the staff started teasing me. They started calling me, well, Bob, you're the Ghostbuster. And I got really irritable and said some things I had to apologize for later. And then that night, as I was going to bed, I thought, this is just some weird thing. I'm just going to forget about this. You know, this kind of stuff does not happen. You know, I'm just, you know, enough. Then that woman started sending me emails from the airport going home from the training. And the first several scared me really badly. She said stuff like, I'm seeing colors I've never seen before. And I can see the God in people. And I'm thinking, oh, no, I have triggered a major manic episode. You know, bad news, malpractice, you know, all these kind of therapist terrors. And then she sent me an email that changed my life. She said, I didn't tell you or anyone at the training this, but when I was a teenager, I was hospitalized, mental hospitalized many times, and I tried to kill myself many times. And back then, when I tried to tell anybody about the non-human inside of me, they gave me electroshock and injected me with big drugs. You're the first human being to ever believe me, and you've changed my life. And I went, I can't ignore this. You know, and it was very uncomfortable because I had this trauma-oriented view and I thought I knew some stuff. And I was about 60. I'm 75 now. And, you know, I'm like, oh, I have to start all over again. You know. But when she said that thing, you know, they gave me electroshock and injected me with drugs. And I didn't really have any skills. I just recognized the possibility that something foreign could be in her mind, and I helped her get it out.
Yeah.
And then I got really interested, and most other therapists don't want to touch this stuff, so I got a lot of referrals. And then I started doing all that massive research, you know, in the book. The bibliography is 32 pages, and
it's a very extensively researched and cited book. Like, you reference a lot of different thinkers and pieces of work.
There's an old saying: extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
And just to be very clear, like, what is, would you say again, and I think you kind of mentioned it, but to put a finer point out, what is the core claim that you're making in this book that you're using so many citations and references to make?
Okay. Some beings or energies or whatever you want to call them can get into our minds that are not part of us. They're not part of our personal history. And they can have incredible bad effects. They can destroy people. They can also have incredibly powerful good effects too. And another claim I would make is that this basic biopsychological dynamic has been recorded in pretty much every culture we have records of and every era of history. The metaphor usually used to describe it is spirit possession. But whatever it is, it's worthy of our study. It deserves attention. And I tried to dumb that down enough so that the most rationalistic materialist person could accept it as, yeah, we should pay attention. But even that, you know, even in the IFS world, people don't want to listen to the stuff I say.
What tends to be the kind of response to this kind of claim? Like people turn away or?
Yeah, you know, they joke about Bob the Ghostbuster or, you know, actually it's been sort of good for me because most therapists don't want to touch this. I think that's because they get scared. So I've gotten a tremendous number of referrals. Recently I had one of the senior lead trainers of IFS read my book and sent me this wonderful glowing email about how courageous and well-researched and blah, blah, blah. And I was so grateful because I get attacked. And I said, oh, can I quote you? And she said, let me think about that. And then a month later, she wrote back and said, no, I don't want you quoting using my name because I want to stay on good terms with the licensing board and with Dick and the Institute.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And Dick did write a foreword to my book, and he's now sort of accepting it, but he has been very afraid that this material will be used to discredit IFS, which he's spent his life developing and spreading.
Yeah. I mean, there is a kind of Faustian bargain that I suppose a lot of these modalities have to make in order to enter into the mainstream.
You know, Carl Jung, who was one of the most adventurous therapists, he hid the Red Book, which was his visionary until 50 years after he was dead. Mm-hmm. And almost many other therapists have hid the spiritual dimensions of what they do.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because there is, as you say, within IFS, I mean, IFS is already, or at least was, kind of on the edge of things, you know, the multiplicity of mind, the kind of reality of capital S self as being this unimpeachably kind of clear and curious and whole dimension or aspect of being. And even within IFS, they have a category, as you said, for these beings or these, I guess you say beings, right? They can get into our mind. They used to call them critters. And I remember reading about critters when I first started learning about IFS, and now they call them unattached burdens. And you said you don't like that term. Why don't you like that term?
I think it's sort of pompous. Hmm. I think it makes us think of them as objects rather than beings. And whatever they are, in working with them, it's better if you treat them as beings. Like this thing in that woman, in the case I mentioned, it seemed to have agency and intention. And, you know, it wasn't like removing a splinter.
Right.
It was more like getting a feral dog out of the house, you know.
Right. And so, you know, you said that people, other IFS therapists started, like, as you became known in that world as the person who kind of works with unattached burdens, you know, actually, what's the term that you would prefer to use instead of unattached burdens?
I like the others within.
Okay.
Because unattached burdens, you've already judged it as something negative. IFS talks about unattached burdens and guides.
Yeah.
You know, and the guides would be the good ones, which is more like, you know, having the Holy Spirit come in or something along those lines. And that also is an incredibly unpopular idea in therapy land. So the others within allows it to be either one, you don't have to decide if this is good or bad right at the get-go.
Great.
Yeah. Tanya Luhrmann, that wonderful anthropologist, she talks about spiritual presence experiences or spiritual presence events. Again, it doesn't judge them right at the start. And you can document spiritual presence experiences in every culture, every era of history. You know, put whatever your ideology tells you about the reality of these things, they're worthy of study. They're ubiquitous. They're perhaps the most widespread cultural artifact we have. So, my God, are you going to ignore this because it doesn't fit your ideology?
Yeah, right. So on the one hand, we have this kind of wealth of historical information and probably anthropology and kind of record and such. And then, you know, for the last however long, 10, 15 years, therapists have been handing you their clients who are in touch with one of these others. How common do you think it is? And what did you discover as you started to work with more of these cases?
Okay. I want to backtrack just a little first.
Sure. Yeah.
This idea that there's something that's not from our personal lifetime within us is foundational. If people can't make that step, the rest of this stuff is gibberish.
Okay.
So I want to say there is another kind of burden that is not from our personal lifetime that we have hard science evidence for. And these are what IFS would call legacy burdens.
Yeah.
And they're what
it's like generational trauma kind of thing.
Generational trauma, right. Yeah. And there's the hard science of epigenetics now. There are all these studies with rats and mice showing that you can do something to one generation and it will have an effect many generations down. And, you know, here in the West, if you can do it with rats, that means it's real. And this was absolutely denied until quite recently. And this is an example of something other than our own personal lifetime that can be in us and have major, major effects on who we are. Hmm. So with that opening of the door, I don't know how common these are because the sample I get is quite skewed.
Right.
But many other cultures, I think Brazil. One of the other things I've noticed as I studied this, we in the modern West are perhaps the most ignorant people on the planet about this stuff. And we are so arrogant and so Eurocentric, we do not listen to anybody else. We don't. It's astounding how narrow-minded we are. Brazil, there's people called the Spiritists who base themselves largely on the work of Alan Kardec, who was a Frenchman. But they believe that they're these spirits, they call them lost souls, who get in people. And they operate over 50 psychiatric hospitals in Brazil that work with psychosis on the basis of getting these kind of energies out of people. And they're quite successful. And they've been doing this 150 years. And almost nobody in America studies these people. Mm-hmm. Most therapists haven't even heard of them. It's like,
incredible.
And you know, the Dalai Lama, who's a hero to many people and who has said point blank, if science and religion conflict, go with science. He still listens to his oracle, who's a possessed oracle. You know, the Tibetan state oracle. I'm forgetting it. I'm spacing out its name right now. But it's clear possession. This deity comes into the oracle and tells the Dalai Lama how to conduct business. Wow. And he listens.
Yeah.
So he obviously considers this real. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, you said something I think that's really interesting, is that there are both others that can have negative consequences and others that can have positive influences on our mind. How what's your sense of how these beings tend to like come through the door? How do they become connected to a mind?
Okay. That's a really good question and not an easy one. For the less friendly ones, let's say the negative ones, it seems to be anytime people are out of their body. And a classic rape, child sexual abuse, almost literally injects foreign energies into the children. Another one that surprised me was childhood surgeries. It seems the anesthesia creates like a vacuum or an opening where other energies can get into people. All sorts of, you know, big T trauma. This happens a lot in PTSD too. Mm-hmm. And you know, actually, as I studied this worldwide, this sort of negative aspect of it, which is what I was my doorway in because of, you know, working in the therapy world, there's much more of the positive aspect of people, monks praying their whole life to have spirit come visit them,
yes.
You know, yeah. And deity yoga, a very clear Hindu practice of inviting the deity in. The Tibetan Buddhism has this, you know, these incredible visualizations and inviting these divine energies down in. And theurgy in our tradition among the Neoplatonists. And I think, even though this gets me in hot water, a lot of the Pentecostal people who are inviting in the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. I think that's inviting in these energies that are not part of us. They're bigger than us. And when they come in, they can completely change our life.
Yes. You know what?
William James is a big hero to me. One of his ideas that's so important is radical pragmatism. You do what works and you let go of your theories. You know, that's sort of humility in practice, I think. But he pointed out something. He called them conversion experiences. He said there's evidence from all over the world that people are capable of having a single experience in a day or a couple of days that completely changes the course of their life. And these were often in like a religious conversion. I don't think they have to be. And there's overwhelming evidence that these things exist. This would be these positive guide energies or whatever you want to call them. This is catty and obnoxious of me to say, but I can't resist. Maybe one reason therapists don't like to talk about this is because it's what we wish we could do and we can't do. You know, can you imagine if we could see people, you know, for a day or so and completely turn their lives around?
Yeah, there's something really interesting here. I mean, well, first maybe I'll ask, like, you know, what, I wonder if there are any common ways that indigenous or intact cultures treat these others that we it's clear that we should learn from them, that there are kind of principles or guiding practices that are really clear.
Right. I go through a lot of cultures in the book. We can't do that. I want to tell this story again. I'm going to go back to Tanya Luhrmann because she specialized in studying psychosis and spirituality multiculturally. And she studied psychosis in San Mateo, California, Accra, Ghana, and Chennai, India. And we spend way more than 100 times the amount either of those other two places do. Guess who gets the worst results? We do. And if the human race was rational at all, we'd be over there studying at their feet. Mm-hmm. That is not what's happening. We are exporting our methods of dealing with psychosis and helping them destroy their traditional healing methods, which, you know, I'm sort of laughing and smiling because if I wasn't, I'd be crying. It's so sad and so depressing. Tanya goes back to that time. Excuse me, I should call her Dr. Luhrmann. I've never met the person, but I've studied her so much, I feel I know her. Yeah. She goes back to that citadel theory of mind. She says, we have this, you know, we think this mind is this private thing. So when we hear a voice or something, we shatter.
Yeah.
In Accra, Ghana, she had what they called an ecocentric. They think mind is part of the environment, and of course it would relate to nature, nature spirits, the gods, all of that. In India, it's more sociocentric. They see mind as being like a family, so they're not stunned or shattered when they hear voices of the deceased aunt or something. You know? So a lot of it's the theory we have about who we are sets us up to have terrible experiences.
Right. Yeah. And this, I think, is something that I've thought about, where it's like, if you were going to design a culture and a theory of mind and a kind of identity structure to specifically keep spirits out, you would end up with something like what we have here in Western culture.
Exactly. And Dr. Lerman, a recent article of hers is I forget, I'm going to get the title a little wrong, but Porosity is the Heart of Religion. That this idea that our minds are open and we're part of a vast system is the heart of religion.
Here's a question. I'm curious what you think the relationship is between trauma and porosity of mind.
Okay. Trauma very often shatters any kind of boundaries we have. So that we can have tastes, we can get these nasty unattached burdens or critters or whatever you want to call them into us. But we also have tastes of the spirit world, like I had with that merciful female presence. Mm-hmm. So the porosity of mind becomes a lived experience. Interestingly, another kind of person who's been coming to me a lot is young people who are having psychic experiences. Because they're often, you know, they say, I can't talk to anyone around this. They'll think I'm crazy. They'll want to medicate me, you know. And if I say stuff, if I just sort of normalize that and say, in any other culture, the kind of experiences and abilities you have would be considered a great gift, a difficult gift, a challenging gift, but really important. And you would be honored as someone who has the visionary ability to help guide the culture. And I just say, I'm so sorry. Our culture is so blind. It makes your life so hard. But what you have is a gift, not a curse.
That's beautiful. And I guess part of what's in it for me is this sense that, you know, I do kind of coaching work, and I work with people with their kind of stuck places. And I have a sense, and I'm very early on in my kind of career, but I've also lived in a monastery. So, you know, I've seen people open up, and there does seem to be this movement from kind of fixation and kind of a very like closed down attention and self, and then more and more gradually, and more a kind of opening to the world and opening to others. And I have a sense that like almost like trauma, and the kind of fixations that arise from it are on a spectrum with a kind of porosity. And so I guess I'm curious if you think that the movement in our culture to really work with and meet trauma is also kind of opening up a portal for the emergence of a deeper sense of the porosity of mind, and therefore a kind of opening to the spirits that may be here but aren't yet welcome in the minds of our culture.
I hope so. I think a lot of things that go on, like AA and the whole 12-step movement, has dumbed down spirituality enough so that we can accept it, you know, by calling it a higher power. Now, everyone, no matter how arrogant and materialist you are, has to accept that they're higher powers. You know, I've done a lot of 12-step stuff, and I live near the ocean. So you could just take somebody down by the ocean and say, which one's bigger?
Yeah, right.
You know, so it makes it simple enough so that everybody could accept this. I think Dick's concept of self is sort of like that too. It makes something fundamentally spiritual acceptable to our very rigid, narrow-minded worldview.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a neuroscientist who I liked a lot, Robert Orenstein, and he talked about the Western intellectual tradition, and he'd abbreviate it TWIT, TWIT.
Yeah, there's another piece of your book that I wanna talk about, maybe for like the last movement of our conversation, perhaps, and it's about imagination. So I engage a kind of practice called the soul-making dharma, and it's this really interesting kind of synthesis of Buddhist practice and I don't know if you know the work of James Hillman.
Yes, I do.
Okay, yeah, and his kind of soul work idea and working with image and things like that. And, you know, within that, there's a distinction between often the imagination and the imaginal.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something in the book that I thought was really beautiful. And I think it clarified something for me that I think wasn't quite clear for me. And you said that the imagination is not what our culture usually thinks it is. It is actually a perceptual system like sight or hearing.
Mm-hmm.
It is the primary perceptual system that allows us to navigate in our internal worlds. Yeah. Okay. So maybe could you kind of unpack that a little bit, and how does that relate to the ability to see or connect with the others that may be around or within us?
Yeah. I don't think that thought's original with me. I'm quite sure it's not. But, you know, the Sufis, for instance, they took, and this is, Henri Corbin was a great French scholar of Sufism, and he went and studied many of the Sufi mystics, and they talk about this realm, this other world, and in their geography of the mind, they say this is the realm beyond Mount Quaff, you know, and Corbin started calling this mundus imaginalis, the world of the imagination. And it is how we can navigate these internal spaces. And you can think of these internal spaces in Jungian terms as being the whole geography of the archetypes and all these ancient forms that are in there. And to navigate through them, we need to learn how to use this sense of imagination and feeling into and visualizing. And I think it's very much like dreams and dream work.
Mm.
It's that same kind of thing. Mm. There are a couple, there's a psychiatrist from Bali, Dr. Suryani, and an anthropologist from Australia, Stefan, or Stefans. Mm. And they've come up with this idea of what they call the autonomous imagination.
Mm.
What they were studying is how traditional healers gain their skills. And traditional healers, whatever you think of them, they do work. Mm. I mean, we should, pragmatic, radical pragmatism, these people get results, sometimes amazing results. And they said it isn't, they don't think it's, you know, learning how to master spirits or anything. They say these people, the shamans, the shamanic training, the shamanic initiation, is actually learning how to move in this realm of the autonomous imagination with power and control.
Mm-hmm.
So that's learning how to be in the imaginal realm, interacting with it, not just accepting it. It's almost like a kind of lucid dreaming.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. And I suppose maybe a good place to kind of focus the end of the conversation is a little bit more practically.
Mm-hmm.
So first, maybe I'd ask, like, if I'm a coach or an IFS practitioner, what kind of amendments or adjustments would you offer to, like, how we hold the practice or how we engage with others around this, such that we make space or kind of accord with what you've discovered in your research?
Okay. The smartest, most brilliant person on this planet is not even in kindergarten yet. We are profoundly ignorant, astoundingly ignorant. We know almost nothing. Whatever your theories are, hold them lightly. And you can be certain that everything you know is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of what there is. I think it was William Butler Yeats had this beautiful image. He said, imagine all of human knowledge is a little bubble shining and iridescent. Mm-hmm. That bubble is in a small patch of seafoam. The seafoam is on an insignificant beach in a small cove on the edge of a vast, dark sea. That's about where we are. And if you know, you can hold that in your hold that and realize that the person in front of you is also a vast dark sea, then maybe you'll treat them with the respect they deserve.
I love that. I love that so much. Yeah. And you know, for me, it's so much of what I long for is a world in which we can see each other exactly that way. Yeah.
And there's lots of practical things, but that would, you know, there's lots of courses you can take and books you can read and nothing I could say in a few minutes, but basically that humility. And we're really small and really ignorant.
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. Well, and so then, and then the last thing I'd ask is just, let's say that I suspect that I or somebody I know, somebody I'm working with, has a kind of not a non-benevolent, a malevolent other within them. What is the kind of, is there a standard operating procedure? Best, like, kind of, what's the way to respond to such a situation?
I wish I had good answers. There are not that many people who deal with this. I've got my book out. I've got a couple courses online you can take. I'm trying to train up a bunch of other people who specialize in this. Many or most IFS therapists deal with this. A lot of religious people deal with this. I want to say this is really important. I don't deal with this like a hostile exorcism at all. That's a huge difference between me and most of the Christians. I think these other beings who attach to people are lost, suffering beings in their own right. The Spiritists in Brazil say this too, and it becomes almost our duty to help them heal. So it's not like this heroic battle of the priest and the demon. It's more like, hey, we know you're suffering too. We can help get you to someplace where you can get what you really need to heal, and we'll get you out of this person, you know, in a nonviolent, loving way. And that seems to work with a lot less collateral damage than this sort of exorcism stuff.
Yeah, and some folks that I know who kind of have explored these areas talk about how fear is the kind of binding agent between these others and our minds. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, super important. There seems to be a law, and you know, that when you're not afraid of things in this imaginal realm, they lose all power. There's a great story from the Tibetan tradition, Milarepa, you know, the monk who'd been a murderer and had to do all this stuff. He comes back to his meditation cave after being away for a long time, and there are all these terrible demons in there, you know, snarling at him. And he says, oh, welcome. And just welcoming them, about half of them disappear. And that the nastier half's still there. So he prepares food for them. And most of them disappear. And there's one horrible looking one with big green teeth drooling and, you know, just, So Milarepa goes over and puts his head in the demon's mouth, and then it too disappears. When you're not afraid of these things, they do seem to lose all power.
Beautiful. Thank you, Bob. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to those who are listening?
Even though it's scary and I felt sort of exiled and, often laughed at for my opinions, I think this is absolutely fascinating and immensely exciting material. And I hope some of the excitement I feel in investigating this and following all the trails comes through.
Yeah, well, I just want to say thank you very much for your work, Bob, and for your courage in stepping forward to do these kind of edgy explorations. I think it really does matter.
Great. Thank you so much, Stu.